Policy and Finance, Wednesday, February 9, 2004. Clerk, take your roll.
Chairman Smith?
Here.
Representative Eastland? Cornish? Ellison?
Here.
Hillstrom?
Here.
Johnson? Meslow? Murphy?
Here.
Nelson?
Here.
Newman?
Here.
Tamar?
Here.
Soderstrom?
All right, today on our agenda, we have an overview of the Governor's budget recommendation for the Minnesota Sentencing Guidelines Commission, followed by a discussion of the impact of the Blakely decision and other sentencing issues. So I'd ask the Executive Director, Barbara Toon, to come forward. And identify yourself and then tell us what we need to know.
My name is Barb Chan. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Sentencing Guidelines Commission.
Ms. Toombs, pull this down. Yes.
Okay, can you hear better now?
Thank you.
Okay. Do you want me to start with the budget presentation?
Yes, please.
And that will be very quick. The governor has allotted $872,000 for the biennium for the Sentencing Commission, which equals out to $436,000 a year. Currently, the agency has 6.4 positions, which is different than, I believe, the budget printout that you had during the time the budget was developed. Part of that is we were going through a reorganization and doing some changing of positions and so forth. And so we come out at 6.4 positions. What I did was to combine two of my administrative positions to allot me an additional position for research, and then I have a part-time researcher who's working with us now. So we have one director and then a management analyst or administrative person, and then five researchers, four full-time and one part-time, 0.04. We chose the 0.04, or 0.40, excuse me, because that allowed us not to have to pay benefits, and that person is going to law school, and it worked out well for us. Our salary, the agency salary and compensations account for between 91 and 93% of the agency. Our rents and utilities is about 8%, leaving us about 1% for operating. I've been in this position about a year and a half, and so since I've come here, we did move to a cheaper, we relocated right after I became director to a facility in which the rent was less, so we have been able to deal with some of the cost savings from that, a reduction in rent. If you look at our allocation for 2004 and 2005, you can see it was 466 in 2004, and 2005 it was 527. Those figures are the result of rollovers. There was a rollover between bienniums, I understand, and then a rollover from the first to second year of the biennium. So basically, we've been able to operate a lot on that rollover money and keep the agency operating, even with the reduction in staff and the reduction. Next year will be more of a challenge. With 1% of our budget for operating, that is not, I think it comes to like $2,000 or $3,000, and from that we must pay communications and supplies and anything else we do, which will probably result in a realistic fact that we will not be able to do it, so we will probably continue to cut back on positions. The agency, just to give you an idea, we processed 14,492 felony sentences last year. This is up from 2001 of 10,796, so we're doing an average of about 4,000 to 5,000 more sentences with less staff. There was a reduction in staff in 2000 also, prior to my assuming this position, so we have reduced staff continually. We do the annual revisions to the guidelines. We also develop and distribute data reports, and those are statutorily required or legislatively required, such as the drug report, or required by the governor, such as the Blakely reports. And then data requests that we keep on going, such as drug offenders, sex offenders, and so forth like that. We processed 17,491 electronic worksheets. These are criminal history worksheets that are submitted by county probation officers prior to sentencing, so that the court knows the criminal history and prior criminal activities of the offenders. There was a time when those were done by hand. They're now done electronically, but we still have to look at each one, validate that it's correct, and contact the probation officer if there's a discrepancy in our records and with what they're submitting to us. We responded to 141 data requests last year, and those were from academics, attorneys, judges, law enforcement, and state agencies. Basically, what people really want to know is comparison data and sentencing. Departure data is a big issue. Sex and drug offenders, sentencing practices, and racial and regional sentencing issues. So we responded to that. We took 3,747 calls last year on questions with sentencing guidelines. Usually those are done by judges or probation officers in preparation of the electronic worksheet, or judges at time of sentencing, or from defense attorneys wanting to clarification on any modifications the sentencing guidelines may have made prior years. So if the law has changed, they want to make sure they understand the new law. So we spend a lot of time answering phone calls. We did 9 trainings to criminal justice professionals, usually judges, attorneys, and probation parole officers. We'll attend trainings, again, to when they become a probation officer, and oftentimes an advanced one showing the changes in the guidelines over a period of time. We assist with the prison population for the Department of Corrections. We take data provided by them and actually operate the statistical model that produces the numbers. So we work in coordination with them. We provided 49 impact policy analysis or impacts last year during a legislative session, which is up from the 24 in 2003. So we've doubled the number of impacts we're doing for you whenever you request bills or when a bill is introduced and then subsequently modified. And then we do ongoing evaluation of sentencing policy. So that's basically what the agency does and how we operate. And I was glad to answer any questions.
Questions. Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So you said that you would have to reduce staff with this budget, with the governor's recommendation?
Assumed.
Chairman Smith, Representative Murphy. Yes, because our operating budget is 1%, and there's a very unlikely ability that we can operate on $1,000 a year for supplies and communication and mailing and things like that.
So, if you reduce staff instead of 5.8, what will it be?
Currently, we have 6.4. That was done prior to some reorganization. My first option would be probably to let our part-time person go, although we don't have a whole lot of dollar savings with that because there's no fringe benefits to go with that position, or another full-time researcher.
And refresh my mind again, how many staff people do you have in your small agency?
We have 6 full-time and 1 part-time.
So that makes you 6.4.
Correct.
And that's for 2005?
Senator, Representative Smith, Representative Murphy, yes.
And did you have a meeting with the governor's staff on your budget? Did you submit a request?
Representative Murphy, no.
So there wasn't any communication on your recommendation at all?
Representative Smith, Representative Murphy, it was my understanding that we were one of the fortunate agencies not to have a reduction in our allocation from the previous year.
That's the part I don't understand. If you didn't have a reduction and you had 6.4 people now, why can't you have 6.4 going into the future?
Representative Smith, Representative Murphy, if you look at our allocations for 2004 and 2005, we've been operating on rollover money. That rollover money, is my understanding, will not be rolled over from 2005 to 2006.
Clarify, Ms. Toombs, the definition of the term rollover money.
Rollover money, in my definition, and I'm new to the state, so if I've got used the wrong definition, please correct me, is the salary savings that the agency had from when the director's position was empty prior to the previous direction. I believe there was 6 months, 6 to 8 months that position was empty. Subsequently, after that, my predecessor was in, stayed for a very short time. There was another year, basically, in which there was no director. So those salary savings that were accumulated were rolled over from the previous biennium, and then I had the reduction in rent. I reclassified some of my positions, and whenever we had an individual leave, we brought somebody in at a lot lower step, so we had some salary savings from that. So when you see the operating money that we have, it's been a combination. We have never operated on 436. It's always been that rollover money since my tenure with the commission.
Mr. Chair, then, I understand now, okay, so there was that money being used for the present tense, but the governor's office still thinks that they're not going to have a reduction. So the governor's office is going to be very surprised, I would think, then, that they're recommending a budget that they thought was covering 6.4, that they're not making a reduction in, and we're only going to have 5.8 people.
Representative Murphy, I'm not at all disagreeing with what I'm hearing. I'm not sure what I'm hearing. Where do you get the notion that that's what the governor's office thinks or intends?
Because of what Ms. Toome said, that they didn't have to go before the governor, take their budget to the governor, because they were one of the fortunate, I believe she said, the fortunate agencies that were having no reduction.
Ms. Toome.
Representative Smith, Representative Murphy, that is correct. We had $436,000 allocated to us last year as our operating budget. But the reason we were able to operate was that we had rollover money from the previous biennium and from the previous year. Thus, we did not reach that point where we were not able to operate the agency.
But you are going to reach that point, am I right?
There was a very, Representative Smith, Representative Murphy, there's a very high likelihood of that, yes.
Ms. Toomes, one of the numbers you recited was, you stated that your agency reviewed and validated 17,491 electronic worksheets.
Mm-hmm.
What's the purpose of that review and validation process?
Representative Smith, what they do, whenever a criminal history or PSI is being conducted on an offender prior to sentencing, electronic worksheet is developed stating their prior criminal history, convictions, and so forth like that. This is all goes to the judge, so when he goes to sentence that person, he has that information in front of him to validate whether they do have a prior conviction or they have out-of-state convictions. Those are submitted to our agency electronically by the counties. We verify that they have calculated the criminal history right, that the information is accurate, and then the county agent uses that information then to make the criminal, the PSI, which goes before the judge at time of sentencing.
So those requests come from, the 17,000 requests come from a same or similar source?
They come from all the counties, yes.
County attorneys?
County, usually it's the county probation officers who are responsible. Some counties it may be the county attorney. Depends on how the county operates.
Like electronic transmission, what, by email? Or
we have a database. They actually fill the form out, complete it at their end, zip it to us, to the computer. We look at it, make sure that it's correct, that if everything is the way it should be. Or if maybe they are not sure how to calculate something, they'll send it and say, is this right? have we counted this right? Because, you know, the way criminal history points are calculated and so forth, it's very important they have it right.
This is a process you've been doing at the inception of the Guidelines Commission in 1981. You've been doing that since then, is that correct?
That is correct, our representative. We have been able to, we moved from paper to electronic. They used to send in paper copies, and now they are sending them in electronically.
Well, back when they were doing it by paper, I don't imagine you got 17,000 requests, or did you? What was the average number of requests then, if you know?
Senator Smith, that was way before my time, and I just know that would be somewhat proportional to the number of felony sentences, which has increased significantly since 1981.
What's the average amount of time it takes to process one electronic worksheet from when you receive it until you send out verification? Are we talking a minute? Are we talking 10 minutes? Do you know?
1 minute. I have the person who actually does it.
Okay.
Depending on the complexity of the worksheet, it takes anywhere from 3 to 5 minutes. The more complex can take longer if they have out-of-state convictions and so forth.
Any other questions at this point? If not, where are we at in your presentation?
I have reached the end of my presentation. Just happy to answer your questions.
Again, any questions on what we've heard thus far? If not, that would bring us to a discussion of the impact of the Blakely decision.
In preparation to describing how Blakely has impacted Minnesota, I just want to touch base a little bit on some of the structural issues of our guidelines that make it applicable to the Blakely decision. The legislature sets the offense definitions and the penalties, so you set the maximum sentences for each felony offense in the state. What the guidelines recommends is basically whether that offender gets prison or probation, and then the length of that prison sentence if it's applicable. The recommendation is based on a severity offense, which is on your vertical axis, and on the offender's prior criminal history score, which is from 0 to 6 plus. In this state, we have determinate sentencing, meaning the offender must serve 2/3 of the sentence pronounced in prison, followed by 1/3 of that sentence on supervision. There is no parole board. They are released at the time of their 2/3 sentence. Okay. You can see the grid there. The vertical axis, as I said, goes from 1 to 11, with 11 being the most serious, 1 being the least serious. The horizontal axis looks at the criminal history, again, 0 being the least and 6 plus being the most comprehensive. And you see the gray area of the guidelines, which is the stay sentence. These are the presumptive probation sentences. If you fall within that category, then your sentence is presumptive probation. And at the coordinates, where you have the criminal history and the severity level, you get a presumptive duration of sentences, just 3 numbers in there. And that is what the guidelines recommend that be imposed on that offender. Okay. Anything outside of that box is considered departure. And the presumptive sentence I'm talking about inside the box is for the typical offense. Departures were designed in the sentencing guideline system for the atypical, that offense that is a little bit different than the ordinary or normal offense. Departure types can be dispositional and durational. Durational meaning the length of sentence is different than what the guidelines recommend, either longer or shorter. Dispositional means the place the offender actually serves the sentence is different. You can go from probation to prison or prison to probation. That would be a dispositional departure. Departures may be up to the statutory max for the offense. However, the courts look very carefully at any sentence that's more than double, although they do have the option to go up to the maximum sentence, and we have seen that happen before. The sentence judge, whenever he departs, must find substantial and compelling reasons to justify the departure, and those reasons are submitted to our office in writing in a departure form. And then either the prosecution or the defense may appeal the sentence. Along comes Blakely v. Washington. Mr. Blakely pled guilty to a kidnapping in Washington State. And the guidelines recommended that his sentence be 53 months, although the statutory maximum for the sentence was 120, so he was well below the statutory maximum. The sentencing judge, upon sentencing, imposed an upward departure of 90 months after the finding that he acted with deliberate cruelty. Not only did he kidnap his wife, but he did it in front of his child and put his woman in her trunk of his car. So, which is also a reason for departure statutorily in the state of Washington. What the court did, the Supreme Court did in Blakely, was they held the finding they had an Apprendi. And in Apprendi, what it said was that other than the fact of a prior criminal conviction, any fact that increases the penalty for a crime beyond the prescribed statutory maximum must be submitted to the jury and proven beyond a reasonable doubt. What the issue becomes is what the statutory maximum is defined as. Under Blakely, in the Apprendi, we looked at the statutory maximum as being the one that was set in statute, the maximum you could rule on. Under Blakely, however, the court ruled that you can, that any fact, the maximum sentence is actually the presumptive sentence that is called for by the guidelines, not the statutory max. So anything that enhances your sentence beyond the presumptive sentence set forth in the guidelines must be presented to a jury and proven beyond a reasonable doubt. That's where it begins to impact the state of Minnesota. So the Sixth Amendment right to a trial by jury requires that any aggravating factors, other than a prior conviction, beyond the presumptive guideline sentence, the one within the box that I talked about, must be either admitted to by the defendant or found by a jury beyond a reasonable doubt. So the impact on Minnesota. The commission was directed by the governor to assess the impact shortly after the Blakely decision came down, which was June 24th of this year. And he requested we have a short-term impact or recommendations in 30 days, followed by long-term recommendations in 60 days. And that the commission used both a subgroup of commission members and then a larger group of prosecutors, defense counsel, and judges. So we had a wide view of both urban and rural issues and try to get a good understanding of what the issues were from their perspective they saw that was potential. Okay. The application to Minnesota. The Minnesota guidelines still remain constitutional under Blakely and subsequently Booker and Fanfan. They determine sentencing still remains, constitutional. However, our current procedure for imposing aggravated departures is unconstitutional and needs to be modified. The commission looked at the very onset of this issue of what we thought was going to happen, and we assumed immediately that durational departures would be impacted. The sentencing guideline structure in Minnesota is very similar to that of Washington State. There are some differences, but Washington State actually patterned their guidelines after us. So there's some similarities. There's a lot of issues raised, whether they were administrative guidelines or legislative guidelines, would they be impacted? We up front figured out right away that we probably were going to be impacted and took immediate action to look at those, how to deal with that. We also have a series of offenses in our statutes where we enhance the sentence for an offender upon the finding that the person poses a threat to public safety, is a predatory offender, has committed heinous crimes, those types of things. And where the court or the judges determine that factor, we figured immediately those would be impacted because, again, it's a finding other than the jury finding. Consecutive sentencing provisions is something that we project will be impacted, not because consecutive sentencing in and of itself violates Blakely. The provision that we have in our consecutive sentencing statutes is that the court must find it's a prior person offense in some of these crimes before they can do a consecutive sentencing. There is no definition for person offense. So the court has been making that ruling, what qualifies as a person offense or a non-person offense. And again, it's subject to a Blakely issue. Dangerous weapons, mandatory minimum, which is the reason that we feel this is going to be impacted, is that although mandatory minimums as a whole are not subject to Blakely, The possession of a dangerous weapon that is not an element of a crime, such as, you know, armed robbery, you would have the gun as part of the offense. If you have a dangerous weapon, perhaps in a drug deal, where it's not part of the offense, drug trafficking, it could be an issue, and currently the court is finding those whether the dangerous weapons were present or not when it's not an element of the crime. And plea proceedings.
Excuse me, Representative Ellison.
Sorry, Chairman Smith, I don't want to interrupt the presentation, but I did not quite catch what Ms. Toombs said about 61911 offenses.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, Representative Ellison, what we're saying is that possession of a dangerous weapon is often an element of crime, so you don't have to prove it. However, if you have a weapon during the commission of a crime that is not where the dangerous weapon is not an element of the crime, the court must find that the weapon was present and used, such in drug trafficking. Thus, it becomes a potential Blakely issue because the court is making that determination and not the jury.
Representative Ellison.
Mr. Chair, should we reserve questions for later? Should we start asking them now? Well, I don't care either way. I can return to it. It's your pleasure.
Let's proceed with the demonstration, so take note of your questions. Go ahead.
Plea proceedings. There is nothing in Blakely or Apprendi that prohibits plea proceedings. We know that the majority of our cases are disposed of through a plea process. What Blakely does is to modify that, makes it necessary to modify our plea process so that they are aware, first of all, that they have Blakely rights and that they voluntarily waive those Blakely rights in the plea process. So we know that the plea process will also have to be modified. However, it does not remain, it does not become unconstitutional in Blakely. Okay, areas that we know that will not be impacted, like I said, the mandatory minimum sentences will not be impacted. This is because of State v. Harris, U.S. v. Harris, the Supreme Court decision in which they said that the courts do have the right to set mandatory sentencing. However, there is some concern expressed throughout the country that may not, Harris may be overruled in time, because the criteria to impose the mandatory minimum has to be decided by the judge. Now, this is, you know, an area that's evolving in law. And so we don't know, but it's a possibility that in the future that we will see a case addressing that issue. Mitigated departures. There's nothing in Blakely or Apprendi that prohibits the courts from putting mitigated or downward departures. Periods of supervision and conditional release. Those are not impacted by Blakely. Nor is the truth in sentencing provisions. They serve 2/3, 1/3. That does not violate anything in that provision. Okay. Areas where we were uncertain in the beginning. Retroactivity provisions. This is something that is across the nation, at the federal and state levels, all over the United States, are dealing with. We have had some subsequent case law in Minnesota that we'll address, talk about in a few moments. However, it has not reached the state Supreme Court yet and has not been clearly defined at the federal level either. Custody status points. Custody status points are something that an offender can receive when he commits a new crime or is convicted of a new crime, when he's on supervision for a previous crime, either probation, post-release, something like that. He commits a new crime. Whenever they sentence him for his new offense, that can be added into it. And thus, it can increase his criminal history. Thus, it can increase the length of the sentence. That was our issue. And there has been some case law in Minnesota that will address that. It appears that that will not be a factor at this point. Probation revocations, whether the probation revocations, the court's determining factors that may revoke someone's probation and put them in prison, and, you know, the executed sentence, whether that's going to be subject to Blakely is still not as clear as we'd like it to be. Restitution amounts ordered by the court. So, as I said, this is an evolving area of law that is coming down both at the state and federal level. There is an unpublished Minnesota Court of Appeals decision, State v. Spiker, which states that at the Minnesota Court of Appeals level, that makes a difference whether your guidelines are statutory or administrative in nature, that the Blakely provisions do apply to them, which was something the Commission believed was going to happen. State Beat Conger came down in October 12th stating that our aggravated durational departures were subject to Blakely provisions. Again, case law showing that we had anticipated that special sentencing provisions. We've had several cases come down, and these are the cases I was talking about where there's a specific provision where the court must find an additional finding besides prior criminal history that would impact that sentence. And we see that the career offender statute, the dangerous offender statute, and the pattern and predatory sex offender statutes all have been had appellate cases that have said that they were subject and have been remanded back to resentencing. Plea proceedings, we had a recent case in November saying that the waiving of the trial and a plea process is not significant enough. You must also waive the right to a jury and your likely rights. Very clearly, they have a right to the jury, and they're moving those. And
Ms. Thomas, if you'd hold just for a minute, I want to introduce a group of students who are with us briefly. Students from the ninth grade class of the Watershed High School from Minneapolis. You're with us in the Public Safety Policy and Finance Committee, and we're looking at an overview of the sentencing guidelines on crime in this state. So I'd like to welcome ninth grade class from Watershed High School in Minneapolis. Welcome. Ms. Toombs, go ahead.
Remember earlier I spoke about durational departures and dispositional departures. At the time Blakely was handed down, the commission believed that it would apply to both dispositional and durational departures. However, there has been subsequent case law, which is at the appellate level, which is saying that it does not apply to dispositional departures, only to durational departures. Thus, you may impose a sentence from prison to probation, from probation to prison, and it's not subject to Blakely. The court's reasoning in that decision was that those were offender characteristics, not offense characteristics, often a judge considered whenever he was imposing a prison sentence over the presumptive non-prison sentence, such as amenability to probation, those kind of issues, and that they wouldn't be subject to the Blakely provisions. And the custody status point that I mentioned earlier, we had a case come down in December 28th saying that, again, these are all Court of Appeals cases which are subject to review by the Minnesota Supreme Court, that custody status points were not subject to Blakely. One of the things that's most important is the retroactivity provision, because at the time Blakely came down, there was much concern in how far back this implication would go. Would it go back to the beginning of the guidelines? Would it go back to Apprendi? Would it go back to just the time that Blakely came down? So that was a very big issue because of the resource allocation it would take on the courts, the prosecution, and the defense counsel. To date, we've had a couple of cases come down referring to retroactivity that Blakely applies to all cases sentenced on or after June 24th that are on direct appeal or on direct appeal. That limits the scope of the cases which will be subject to remand back for resentencing and so forth. The court also in November ruled that it does not go back to the application of Apprendi, that Blakely creates a new rule, thus becomes effective at the time Blakely was handed down, which was June 24th, or any cases for which there is direct appeal open at that time. That may not sound like a big issue, those last two things to you, but they are, because it actually helps us to identify the number of cases which would be impacted in the state of Minnesota. We look at 2003 data. We had 14,492 offenders sentenced. Okay, of that, we had 1,064 aggravated departures. Of that, we had, and this is where the dispositional and durational departure issue becomes, we just look at the durational departures and don't consider dispositional departures because of current case law. We have 542. So you can see how the impact is limited. Then we look at the number of cases in which there was an aggravated durational departure in which there was no agreement between the prosecution and defense on the sentence, where there was no contesting of the sentencing. And that number is, again, down to 255. So although there is an impact on the state, it is a manageable impact. The courts have been very proactive, and even prior to a lot of these case laws coming down, addressing some of the issues that had to deal with Blakely. The commission's recommendations on how the state should work, respond to Blakely is to, again, we looked at the grid expansion, looking at, again, how can we limit the number of cases that would be subject to the jury or the bifurcated process, or the jury findings that are outlined of the Sixth Amendment in Blakely. Under current statute, the Sentencing Commission has always had the authority to expand the grid cells 15% of this, from the time the guidelines were impacted, it said a 15% range. That has never been consistently done or invoked. And so what the commission looked at was looking at the grid cells and making it a consistent 15% up and 15% down for the proportionality issue the guidelines address in the grid. Also, although there is a limited impact as a result of the expansion, it does take take part of that 250-some cases that would be impacted. Consecutive sentencing. Again, I mentioned earlier about the person offense issue that became Blakely related. What the commission said is that we wanted to make a list of applicable offenses. Trying to define something as person or non-person becomes very difficult. It's not a clean-cut thing. So we looked at the offenses that were in the code and presented in our report to the legislature a list of offenses that we thought were serious in nature enough or involved elements that we thought would be applicable to consecutive sentencing. There was no intention on the commission's part to represent these as person or non-person crimes. We actually just presented a list that we felt was appropriate for consecutive sentencing consideration. Okay. We also looked at the statutory sentencing crimes, as I noted before, and recommend that we do some modification of language to replace the word court or judge with a jury. The mandatory minimum committed with a dangerous offense, which I spoke of briefly before, again, indicating that perhaps that would be one that we would consider to be sent to a jury, a modification. The other recommendations. The commission, when you look at the sentencing issues with Blakely, the guidelines control who is sentenced on the grid. We have limited control of sentences off the grid or departures. So a lot of other parties or entities were involved in this process. We talked about the plea pre and the plea trial process being modified to accommodate Blakely. Plea agreements, again, making sure that the person is waiving not only his right to acknowledging the aggravating factors, but also waiving his right to a jury determination of those aggravating factors, since both of those elements have to be present. Trial procedures. The commission recommends a bifurcated proceeding for the special statutory enhancements. And when we say bifurcated, we're not limiting to specific trials. There's different ways you can bifurcate. You can have a jury determine innocent guilt, and then you can have a jury determine the sentence. You can also have a jury determine innocent guilt, and by the use of special jury verdict form, come up with a sentence. So when we're saying bifurcation, for those cases that we felt were serious enough, especially the increased statutory provisions, and perhaps the one with the weapons offense, that a bifurcated procedure of some form, not necessarily meaning you have to impanel a jury, but a bifurcation where you find a guilt and innocent and subsequently a finding by that jury through acceptable means to impose the sentence. Okay, just recently we had a subsequent U.S. Supreme Court decision come down after Blakely, U.S. v. Booker. And these were cases that were filed. Blakely came down on June 24th. The Supreme Court agreed to hear Booker and Fanfan on its first day of its fall session, which tells you the urgency that we were looking for and trying to clarify what exactly Blakely means. And they agreed to hear these two cases, and these decisions came down here in January. In Booker, the person was found guilty of 50 large amount of drugs, 50 grams of drugs, and had a guideline sentence of 210 to 262 months. The judge makes the additional findings that the defendant had more drugs and also obstructed justice, and he imposes a sentence of 30 years. So he imposes an upward departure because of his findings. Okay. In San Fan, we have the exact opposite happen. The defendant is charged with conspiracy to distribute 500 grams of cocaine. He's found guilty by a jury and subject to 78 months. The judge also finds that he had additional factors that could enhance his sentence. However, the judge in this case chooses not to enhance the sentence, saying that he could not impose the sentence because of Blakely. So you have the same type of a case, a drug case involving drugs and additional enhancing factors. And one is in Booker, they choose to invoke the increased sentence. In Fan-Fan, the court decides not to. Both of these decisions go before the Supreme Court for ruling. And what does this mean? So on January 12th, it comes down. This is a two-pronged decision from the U.S. Supreme Court. It doesn't really help us at the state level very much, other than it kind of addresses the retroactivity provision. Basically, it says that the federal courts, although they argued from the very beginning because they were administrative in nature, they were not subject to Blakely, they are subject to Blakely. That violates the Sixth Amendment. The second part of the Supreme Court's decision is how they tell them, not only are your guidelines unconstitutional now, but now we're going to tell you how to fix them. And they basically make them advisory instead of mandatory and use the reasonable sentence standard for review. No one has quite been able to define what reasonable sentence standard means at this point, so this is just an indication there will be more subsequent decisions. But the impact on Minnesota is it reaffirms again the finding in Apprendi and Blakely for us that there is an aggravated sentences that you must have the provision of a right to a jury trial and a reasonable doubt standard. Okay, so we'll stop here and I'll answer any questions you want to know. I think, one of the big differences you have to keep in mind is the construct of the federal guidelines is so different than the states that the impact that the federal guidelines is undergoing currently is much more pervasive and much more difficult than the states are. There's not one state who has constructed their guidelines to mimic the federal guidelines. Part of that is that the guidelines, federal guidelines, do not have a criminal code like we have where they have different levels of offenses, such as assault with bodily harm, serious bodily harm, great bodily harm. Those factors all become enhancing factors within the federal guideline system. So thus they are subject to Blakely and jury modification. The other big difference is the relevant conduct. In the federal guidelines, it's possible that you can be sentenced for a crime in which it was dismissed, you were found not guilty of, by using the relevant conduct status and thus enhancing your sentence. So those two big things make the biggest difference, I think, in how this is progressing at the state level. Also, I think states are dealing with much smaller numbers. In the federal system, the figure between 40% and 60% of their cases involve aggravated departures or an aggravated enhancement sentence, much different than state levels. But again, part of it is probably the way our systems are set up. So although we do have an impact, I think it can be addressed with some modifications and the cooperation. I think the cooperation I have witnessed between the courts, the prosecutors, and the defense counsels has been very good, wanting to work this out, make sure that the sentence imposed is a fair and right sentence, and that we're protecting public safety. So answer any questions.
Representative Ellison.
Mr. Chair. Ms. Toombs, given Booker, does that mean now that the state sentencing guidelines are only advisory? I guess that you could argue that they have always been advisory, but given Booker, do you see that that is applicable to the states as basically wiping out the guidelines structure as well?
Representative Smith. Representative Allison. No, the decision in Booker and Phantom were the federal guidelines. And again, I think the complexity of their guidelines, they were not able to sever out different areas that could be corrected because it's one builds on another. And so they were not able to extract the areas that could be corrected easily and modified, which people often refer to as Blakely eyes, because it was inherent within their whole system.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Ellison.
I hear what you're saying. It's just that when I remember Apprendi came down, everybody thought that the statutory maximum was the ceiling. Then Blakely comes down, and then we see that the statutory max is not the ceiling. The guidelines is the ceiling. And so I guess I'm not so sure that Booker does not apply to state sentencing guideline schemes. I'm not asking you to respond, but if you care to, I'd be interested in what you think.
Ms. Toombs.
The issue in Blakely and Apprendi is that any time you enhance a sentence beyond the presumptive sentence, that you either have to waive those rights or agree to the aggravating factors, or they must be presented to a jury and proven beyond a reasonable doubt. Within our system, we can identify when the situations occur, and we can accommodate those either through the plea process or through the bifurcated hearing process. So it's not that the guidelines are unconstitutional themselves. It's a process. If we can assure that every defendant has that process available to him, then our guidelines remain constitutional.
Okay. Little.
Senator Bellison.
Mr. Chair, could you offer your thoughts on what's actually going on here? I mean, we have a whole line of cases now. We have, you know, we have Apprendi. Actually, there was a precursor to Apprendi, I believe. But the big ones are Apprendi. Then we have Blakely. Now we have Booker. We have a number of state cases. What is the Supreme Court telling us? What messages, in your view, are we to receive here? Is it accurate to say that perhaps the state legislatures and Congress have been engaging in sentencing inflation for the last 20 years, which the Supreme Court doesn't think is right, so they're essentially setting up some procedural barriers to slow it all down? Do you see it that way? How do you see it? Is there any lesson to be learned when you look at the bigger picture?
Ms. Toombs.
I'm afraid you're going to ask me that. I guess in looking at it, and again, I spent a great deal of my last 6-7 months on this. There's different perspectives. I think there is, and you've got to remember, these cases are coming down at the federal level. Although they do affect the states, these are federal cases that are coming down at the federal level. But there does seem to be some conflict between Congress and in the courts. But again, I think what makes the states so much different than the federal government, and I cannot say this often enough or strongly enough, that, you know, you cannot gauge sentencing guidelines, whether in Minnesota, Washington, Ohio, or Pennsylvania, by the federal, is that Congress does not have to balance its budget. Congress does not have to worry about how they're going to pay for anything. And corrections is such a small part of the federal government that they operate differently than the states. So I think, you know, that has to be considered when you're looking at what's going on between Congress and the courts.
Representative Ellison.
Do you think, Madam Chair, that we're going to see fewer motions for upward departure, durational departure in the future? Today it would require that the prosecutor, you know, submit the issue in the beginning of the case, that there be a jury finding, or do you think it'll just get worked into the system and we'll kind of treat criminal verdicts the same way we do civil verdicts with special questions? What do you see the future? Do you see us having a reduction in upward departures, or do you think it's not really going to make much difference after we get used to it?
Yes, too.
Representative Smith, Representative Allison, I've had the advantage or disadvantage of going through this once before in Kansas. Apprendi did affect Kansas because of the way their guidelines were developed, being that their upper number on their grid was their statutory max, and thus anything that was enhanced, which was responsive to Blakely, I mean to Apprendi. I think they were the only states in the United States at that time that was affected by that. There was a lot of concern that this would change the way things were done. That was back in 2001, 2002. They continued on with a bifurcated procedure. It does not change much. I think we have to give credit or at least acknowledge the wisdom of our judiciary. When I see upward departures, they are usually very well justified. They happen predominantly in two types of offenses, sex offenses and murder, in which the circumstances surrounding them are significant. And the departures, as I mentioned earlier, even with the expansion of the 15% grid cells, that will capture a limited number of departures. Most of the departures that are serious enough are, you know, very long departures. They are the doubling of the sentence, or three-fourths of a sentence, or something like that. And I do have ultimate respect for both the prosecution, defense, and judicial representatives in the state, that when a case needs to be departed on, it is departed on. So I think with the modifications to the plea process, the modification for trials that is necessary, either through special instructions or a bifurcated proceeding, that the state will accommodate this without little interruption.
Thank you. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Toombs, I'm new to this committee, so I'm still learning some of this, so you may have to help me out here to make sure I have it right. But just from looking at the way our grid is set up, I'm assuming there are very few cases where the guidelines are going to include the statutory maximum. Is that right?
You're right. Chairman Smith, Representative Johnson, there are no current guidelines. There is nowhere where the statutory maximum is on our grid.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Johnson.
And so, Ms., if one way to address the Blakely problem, if we want to call it a problem, and I think it could be, especially after hearing what Mr. Kyer told us in the last couple of days about their budget with the Public Defender's Office, this is going to increase that, certainly, without the question. Is one way to deal with that to go further than your 15% expansion of the cells, so that at least some, if not many, of the guidelines reach the statutory maximum? Would that help address this problem?
Chairman Smith, Representative Johnson, yes, that's an easy fix. However, the trade-off for doing that is you lose proportionality. There's larger disparity in sentencing. There's also limited ability to predict correctional resources, because you have nothing to base on what's that sentence. You're looking between a presumptive and a statutory max, and you have a long ways in there. Again, going back to what the basis of the sentencing system that you enacted in the state, you know, proportionality, reduced disparity, equity in sentencing across the board, with that kind of a range, will the person have a reasonable expectation of being sentenced in outstate instead of the same as in urban areas? Those are all issues, the policy decisions you must consider.
Representative Johnson.
And I think that's fair, but I think there's also, there has to be some assumption that the judges that we have in place are fair, and I think there also has to be, I guess I didn't realize that in no case would the guidelines include our statutory maximum. To me, they should, at least in the most extreme cases. That seems to me to be kind of ignoring the judgment of the legislature. Let me ask one more question. What does it take to change the guidelines with the process for that in Minnesota?
Ms. Toombs.
Representative Smith, Representative Johnson, when you are referring to change the guidelines, are you talking about modifications to the procedures or changing statutory maxes?
Mr. Chair, not changing statutory maxes, because I assume that's what we do, but increasing the guidelines, having, a larger expansion of your cells.
Representative Smith, Representative Johnson, what the procedure for modifying the guidelines is that the commission brings recommendations to the proposed guidelines to the legislature. If the legislature takes no action on them, they become effective the following August, I believe. So it would be something, a proposal for the modifications, or if you so choose, the legislature can always enact their own modifications.
Thank you. Representative Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Combs, different way to ask the question that Representative Johnson was asking. How does Blakely affect those states with indeterminate sentencing?
States with
Representative
Smith, Representative Newman. As it stands right now, it appears that states with indeterminate sentencing are not impacted by Blakely.
Representative Newman.
A different question on the issue of the bifurcation. Would I be correct that the fact issue to be submitted to the jury in a bifurcated matter would occur in, say, a penalty phase, you know, after the trial, or is it going to be done in some other way?
Chairman Smith, Representative Newman, that would depend on the nature of the aggravating factor. Some aggravating factors could be presented during the trial as part of circumstances surrounding the offense. It would not be prejudicial to the offense, the defendant. An example I can think of, if you are perhaps abusing a 13-year-old within their home. Okay, so the fact that you abuse the child in a zone of privacy, their home, is something that would come out in the natural course of that trial with the abuse of a 13-year-old. So that, you know, I think what we are recommending is that in cases in which the aggravating factor is not prejudicial to the defendant, it could be part of the trial. Cases where it may be prejudicial to the defendant would probably be done in a subsequent or in the penalty phase. So it's almost a case-by-case basis.
Representative Newman.
Thank you, Chairman Smith. Just one sort of more of an observation than a question would be that, you know, if we get into a situation where we're going to have a penalty phase trial in even a minority of the criminal cases, let alone a majority of the criminal cases, we're going to wind up going through two trials in every criminal action. I can't even begin to imagine the cost to the state of Minnesota.
Representative Smith, Representative Newman, that was the exact sentiment that Kansas expressed concern over that. Oftentimes the trials are immediately following, so you're using the same jury, the extension, and this wouldn't be for all cases. For more complicated cases, yes, it may go on for a couple of days, but you're using the same jury for 4 or 5 hours more. And it does not seem to be a big factor in the only state that has actually done this.
Any questions? Ms. Toombs, just to clarify, going back to one of your slides on the role of the commission directed by the governor to assess the impact, requested to develop and submit short-term recommendations in 30 days, requested to develop and submit long-term recommendation in 60 days. Have we then arrived at the process you just described a moment ago that the Guidelines Commission has proposed changes and that we're now in that window of doing something by the end of May, or they become changes in August?
Chairman Smith, yes, in your report to the legislature, I believe you have it in front of you, we have special recommendations that we are recommending that the modifications be done to the guidelines themselves to address the impact of Blakely on Minnesota sentencing.
Can you direct me to the page or pages that those are on?
They begin on page 11 and go through page 19 that are dealing with Blakely.
Mm-hmm. think we can move on unless there's no other questions.
Thank you. Also contained in the report before you, the report to the 2005 legislature, is some proposals the commission, or some modifications the commission is making in response or recommendation to sentencing of sex offenders. And so I'm just going to show you here that, again, just briefly, you can see how the number of felony sentences has increased significantly, especially in the last 3 years. We're seeing a jump from around 10,395 in 2001 up to 14,492. And these, again, are all felony offender sentences. And we looked at the number of sex offender sentences, and you can see that sex offenders peaked in 1994 and has been showing a slow decline, a slight increase in the last couple of years. But I think what's important to notice in this slide is the types of offenses. That we've had an increase in the fourth other category. We've had an increase in the IFS, which is interfamiliar sexual activities. So, and a decrease in other child. That's where there's no significant relationship between the child and the perpetrator. I mean, they're not blood relatives. It could be a live-in boyfriend. It could be something like that. But there's no blood relationship with that. So as you can see, since about 1998, it's been varying, a little slight increase there, but it's not on the increase in proportion to the all felony sentences. Okay. Then we looked at 1981 and 2003, and what's going on with those sex offenses there. As you can see, and I think you made mention earlier about the number of sentences we processed. In 1981, we processed 5,500 sentences. Which is almost three times as much. We're up to about 14,492 in 2003. And proportionally, if you look at percentage-wise, you can see that sex offenders made 6% of the total number of sentences in 81 and 4% in 2003. So percentage-wise, there has been a slight decrease in what they represent overall with our sentencing structure. We looked at the degree of sex offenses in general, and we had 607 last year, total sex offenses, and how they broke down by degree. And it's CRIMSEX 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5 are basically the categorizing of our sex offenses. And the differences between the different levels have to do with the age of the victim, whether penetration or contact occurred, whether there was force, degree of injury to the victim. There's a lot of things that break these down into different categories. First degree, of course, is the most serious, and they make up about 28% of them, of our CRIMSEX. Second degree, which is all contact, is 22%. Third degree has contact and penetration, but the penetration is more or less determined by age. It's when you have the 16, 18-year-old, the real close situations like that. Then we looked at the number of sex offenders who are repeat offenders. A lot of concern had been, a lot of fear, a lot of apprehension is out there about repeat sex offenders. As you can see, that 78% of the offenders sentenced for CRIMSEX did not have a repeat offense. 9% had a true prior sex offense, and the other had, 13% had other prior sex offense. What we mean by true prior sex offense is that they were sentenced for a sex offense before they commit the next sex offense. What you have with the other prior sex offenses, when you have multiple sentencing or multiple victims that occur over a period of time, and you're going to sentence the offender, and you're going to sentence him on one day for three or four offenses. Those prior offenses become part of the criminal history, but they're not considered true prior offenses because he was not sentenced prior to committing the next one. That's the biggest difference there. So really, if you have someone who's doing multiple rapes in a neighborhood and you sentence them and you're going to convict them on house A, B, and C, and you've sentenced them for A, and then you're going to sentence them to B, A becomes a prior for B, and then when you sentence for C, A and B become priors to C. However, in true prior, he would have to commit the crime, get sentenced, and then go out and commit rape C. That's the biggest difference here, and I want to differentiate that for you. The incarceration rate. This is for all felonies. As you can see, for all felonies, 66% at jail, 24% at felonies, and 10% get another sanction. When we look at sex offenders, we've got changes considerably. Compared to the 24%, 52% get prison, and only 41% at jail. So what that's telling us is that sex offenses are treated a little bit differently. You have higher propensity of going to prison and less jail time, and a reduced number of other sanctions available if your offense is a sex offense. Okay, average pronounced sentence. Looking at this, we're looking at 3 years, 1991, 97, and 2003. I picked 1991 because there was a significant increase in sentencing, sex sentencing by the commission in 89. So to do it prior to 89 really distorts it. But you can see that they have gone up considerably. There is some statutory presumptive sentences there that are impacting that. You had the 144-month presumptive sentence for crim sex 1 that went into effect, I believe, in 2001. And you had the 90-month for crim sex 2 that went into effect recently also. So those are driving some of those numbers up also. But you can see that for most sex offenses, the length of sentence has been increasing since 1991. Departure rate. We talked about departures. Again, in Minnesota, 74% of our sentences are within the presumptive sentence range. We have 90% downward and 6% upward overall. And these are for all felony sentences. Now, when you look at sex offenses, you see a little bit different. You can see that the that 74% drops to 62%. And that upward increases to 14%. This is what I was mentioning before. In cases where they are not the typical crime, which is what the presumptive sentence is supposed to look at, the typical crime, when there is aggravating factors, they are getting longer sentences. They have a higher percentage of aggravated sentences for sex offenses and offenses across board generally. Dispositional departures. And we're talking about whether they get prison or probation. When they should have gotten prison, you see that, when they should have got probation, about 8% get prison. So again, this is a high dispositional rate for sex offenses. When they should have gotten prison, only about 29% are getting probation. So then we looked at departure rates, durational. Remember I said you can have longer or shorter sentences? So if you look at this by the severity level, with severity level 9 being your most serious sex offenses. These are your penetrations involving small children, violence, and so forth like that. You can see that aggravated and mitigated departure rates are fairly even, meaning that of the sentences supposed to get about half the time they're getting more and about half the time they're getting less. And what you have to think about or remember in dealing with sex offenses is that they're not clean-cut offenses. Maybe I'm using the wrong terminology there, but meaning that there's so many circumstances that goes into sentencing practices with sex offenses. You know, oftentimes, not wanting the victim to testify, the trauma, the availability, all these different issues that you may not have in a carjacking or in a burglary. That you just can't look at the actual sentence and say that was not the right sentence. You know, the court's looking and the prosecution, defense is looking at all of these things. So you need some flexibility there in looking at those. You don't see until you get down to your level 5, 6, and 4 where you start seeing the aggravated departures being significantly longer than the mitigated departures. And those are your lower level sex offenses. We looked at departure rates by true prior and no true prior. You can see when there is a true prior, there is a big difference in the number of people who get a departure rate on those. So again, the court looking very seriously at whether that offender had a prior sex conviction in sentencing. In trying to deal with sex offenses, we did this. Commission's recommendation comes to you twofold purposes. Basically, there was a lot of discussion last year during the session on alternative sentencing for sex offenders. There were different versions of different bills from both bodies. So there was a keen interest, we felt, in doing something that was in response to what was perceived to be as inappropriate sentencing provisions for sex offenders. The other issue was Blakely. Again, I said, you know, the two areas in which we see the most aggravated or upward departures are sex offenses and second-degree murder. So even though we assume that the expansion on the grid, the departures for sex offenses are much higher. I mean, the sentences, I mean, it's not a couple months. They're usually significantly longer. So, again, wanting to make sure that that departures or that enhanced sentence is available for sex offenders and to limit the impact on the courts and the system. And the commission just recognizes that sex offenders produce a very different type of public safety threat. Also, you know, I would be lying if I wouldn't tell you that we believe in determinate sentencing. I think that, you know, again, trying to maintain a determinate sentencing structure that the state has chosen to impose, and that I believe very strongly and the commission believes in, will address issues of proportionality and certainty and victim concern and so forth, and to reduce the racial and gender practice. Since that a lot of the provisions that were brought forth were indeterminate sentencing in nature. Again, the truth in sentencing, what that person is sentenced to, they will actually serve. And I guess that's my biggest issue with indeterminate sentencing, is there is no truth in sentencing. You know, you have a range, and you really know how long that person is going to serve that sentence. And that the sentence length should be based on a combination of presumptive sentences and statutory maxes. If you look at our current sentencing grid, because of the presumptive 144 months, because of the presumptive 90 months that's been enacted, they don't fit on the sentencing grid. The grid's just, we're like putting square pegs in round holes. We're trying to fit sentences proportionally to other sentences that we think create the same amount of harm to the victim. However, the sentence range within that severity level doesn't work. I mean, to get 144 months on a severity level 9, which is the most serious crime statute, you have to go clear of the criminal history category 4 to get that on that grid level. So because of some changes over time, plus the mandatory minimums, you know, when you put mandatory minimums, they presumpt the guideline sentence. Well, you try to place that mandatory minimum on the guidelines where it fits with other sentences of like harm, but sometimes it doesn't fit in the sentencing range. So sex offenses just create a real real challenge, I would say.
Ms. Toombs, let's go to a question. Representative Pilstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Back to the truth in sentencing issue. Is there financial or money that we get from the federal government for truth in sentencing? Is that? I think I remember hearing that.
There was voted money at one time. Violent offenders and incarceration, truth and sentencing money. However, that has been discontinued at the federal level, and Department of Corrections would be the appropriate person to ask whether we have any remaining funds or how those are allocated. That is not a federal distribution to the states any longer.
Go ahead.
So the commission's recommendation was to take sex offenders off the sentencing grid and create a different grid structure to deal with them. This is not a novel approach. It's been done in other states with other offender populations. Washington State has done it. Kansas, it was with drug offenders. It's allowing a sentencing structure for a particular offender group that you feel needs to be treated differently, for whatever reason you feel they need to be treated differently, but to let the rest of your system remain intact. So we actually constructed a grid. I think we have a copy of it, where A, and it's the most serious, and H is the least serious. We chose to go that direction so that we didn't get confused with the non-sex grid, which is numeric. The presumptive sentence for criminal history zero, actually replicates the statutory max, mandatory minimum or the presumptive sentence. So there is that zero criminal history shows the least amount of sentence that person should get under current law for sex offenses. Also, in response to Representative Johnson's question earlier, the criminal history category 6 or more does contain, for most, almost all of these, the statutory maximum. So we did bring the statutory maximum sentence, which is absent from the non-sex grid, onto this grid. Again, because of the issues involved with sex offenders. And the presumptive sentence for the criminal history 3 is about two-thirds the statutory max. So The rationale behind that was that would mean if you had one prior, the second time around you were coming in, you were getting hit with a really long sentence, two-thirds statutory max, which under current sentencing structure on the grid would not be possible. Criminal history score. Although a lot of research says that there is not a lot of repeat offenses in sexual offenses, the ones that are repeat offenders are very serious and dangerous offenders. Thus, we thought they do pose the greatest threat to public safety and to our children. We increase the weights for prior sex offenses when the current sex offense. Currently, if you have a prior felony and you're being sentenced for a felony, you get one criminal history point, or 1.5, or 2, depending on the type of felony. So it's weighted. With the current crime being a sex offense and having any prior sex offense, we're going to weight it at 3. So you're automatically going over to Category 3. Again, holding that offender much more accountable for prior convictions than what is currently held on the non-sex grid. Second custody point is a status. We talked about custody status points. If you get one custody status point now, if you commit a crime while you're on supervision for another felony, this would assign 2 custody status points to you. Again, holding that, you know, if they're on community supervision for a sex offense and they commit another crime, they're automatically getting 2 points. Just for that point of being on supervision, let alone any prior criminal histories they may have. Okay? The effect on this criminal history score is that, you know, if they have on supervision and they have a prior sex offense, they will get at least 2/3 statutory max. If the new sex offense has a prior first degree, they will, conduct, they will have 2/3 statutory max. A new sex offense with 2 priors would give them the actual statutory max also. So we've incorporated that statutory max that was often brought forward in the indeterminate sentencing in a more structured and, I believe, logical process. Failure to register as a predatory offender is not per se a sex offense in the fact that it does not harm a victim. However, because it's so closely connected with sex offense, we thought it should be on this grid. We chose to take it off the non-sex grid and put it on this grid. It's the lowest level. But as you look at the grid, you can see that it's all presumptive incarceration, though. There is no presumptive non-prison sentence for that. That is as a result of current statutory law. And putting it on there, I think it's cleaner, and it also poses the same threat to public safety. Okay. Despite it being ranked at the bottom of the grid, failure to register is presumptive prison, and the mandatory minimum would be applicable. One thing I also want you to note, in the presumptive non-prison part of that grid, we reduced the number of non-prison cells, and we also increased the numbers. Well, those are the underlying prison sentences. So even if they do get a presumptive non-prison sentence, they're in the gray part of the grid, the number of boxes are reduced from the non-sex grid. That means they have less chance of getting probation. And the underlying prison sentence that's posed in those boxes is higher. So even though we're saying you still have certain cases in which a presumptive non-prison sentence may be appropriate, if you screw up, you're going to do more time in prison than you would on the current grid. Okay. And again, I just had a copy of the grid for you. I figured it would be easier for you to look at it unless you have really good eyes.
Ms. Toombs, on that grid, the bottom line, on the line that says registration of predatory offenders, then the next box is H and the next box has 12 and some other numbers. What does that I'm trying to figure out what that box means. Tell me what that
means. That they would do 12 months in prison, because that's the minimum sentence they can impose.
That's in the column with 0 prior offenses. How can you fail to register if you have no prior sexual offense?
No, they could have a prior sex offense, but the mandatory minimum sentence for that failure to register would be 12 months.
with a criminal history of zero, I don't understand.
That is the mandatory minimum sentence that's in statute that can be imposed for failure to register.
Does appearing in that column with zero at the top mean there's no prior offense?
Failure to register, you cannot, you cannot penalize somebody with criminal history whenever that is an element of the offense. You could not be required to register as a sex offender unless you've been convicted of a sex offense. Thus, if you were to move that person over to, say, Category 1 or 2, you are penalizing that person twice because, first of all, they have to get the conviction for the sex offense and then have the mandatory sentence imposed. So you're hitting them. Am I following? You're not following me, are you?
I'm listening intently.
Okay. What I'm saying is, you know, you cannot be required to register as a sex offender unless you've committed a sex offense, okay? So you don't want to count that as prior criminal history because that's an element of the offense of failing to register. You have got to have committed a sex offense that requires you to register before you can be convicted of failure to register. I haven't explained this well enough.
So there's a separate second offense with a zero criminal history.
Yes. So you're not looking at the prior sex offense as being counted in that criminal history because that was an element of that offense. Because you must have a sex offense before you can fail to register for a sex offense.
Any questions on this point? Representative Ellison.
I think I'm one of those people not really getting your point.
Okay, let me give you another example.
Well, let me lay an example out to you. This might dispel part of the thing. If a person gets convicted of a registrable offense, a sex offense, and then that person goes out and doesn't register, that person will be a Category 1, right?
It will be a Category 0.
Okay, now explain why that person with a prior conviction who went out and did not register is a 0 as opposed to a 1.
Because in order to be able to have the requirement to register, you must be convicted of a felony sex offense that requires recommendation. Okay, so that is part of the element or part of the offense to register. So you would be counting it twice if you were not to count. Here's an example. Here's a better example. Okay, so you have to have three felony juvenile offenses before you can be classified as an adult, right? It's just an example, okay? You commit three, this is just hypothetical now. Work with me. It's a three felony offenses. So Johnny goes out and he robs three stores, okay? Okay, we're going to sentence him as an adult now. So do we give him three prior criminal history points on the adult grid? No, because Johnny had to get those three to get the felony to begin with, to get on the adult grid. You can't count it twice. Either the three felonies got him into the adult and he starts at zero criminal history, or you sentence him at a juvenile for three juvenile felonies. So does that help at all?
Mr. Chair? Or do you want to stop talking?
Not at all. I have stopped talking about it. Representative Johnson, you may talk about it.
Thank you. Ms. Toombs, I see that as very different because in your sex offender example, you have somebody who has done two separate things wrong, committed a sex offense, and then later chose not to register. And so to me, they should be in the Category 1 because they've done two different things, even if one happens to require the other.
But
he would not have had to register.
What?
Representative Smith, Representative Johnson, he would not have had to register had he not committed the sex crime.
Sure. He still did two things wrong.
Yes.
Separate thing.
And he's being punished just not using the prior sex offense in criminal history. He's still getting punished for two crimes. Now, if he fails to register the second time, then he goes over to one, and he goes that way.
Okay, we got Representative Newman, Representative Cornish, and then Representative Smith. Representative Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Toombs, I agree with Representative Ellison and Representative Johnson that at least insofar as Representative Ellison's example, the individual should be in the number one category. So my question is there any reason why we can't change the proposed sex offender grid?
Mm-hmm. Ms. Toombs.
Representative Smith, Representative Newman, this body has the authority to do anything they want to.
There you go. As long as we can get 50 or 60 of our brothers and sisters to agree with us. Representative Cornish.
I guess the question has been kind of answered by Representative Newman, because he's thinking the same thing. I totally understand what you just said. I fall in that weird category and understood you. But I'm just disagreeing with you. I see how you got to that point. I'm just saying I think that the point should, if somebody gets out of the joint and fails to register, that should be a second offense in mind and move them up. But I see what you're saying. You can't double jeopardy, use it both to classify to be in that category and an enhancement factor in that category. But I think, in my experience, the failure to register is just a starting point. That means you haven't got this dude's attention yet. He doesn't realize the basic requirements of getting out. He's violated his first privilege. And if you're going to be out, you got to register. You haven't got his attention. That's why I think it should be a separate offense in a more severe category and up the scale. It's just a philosophical difference between me and the sentencing guidelines people that I think it should be a more severe offense.
We need to proceed. However, I'm not asking necessarily for justification, but I want a clarification. On this grid, in the shaded area, that's where there is no presumed jail time or prison time. That's correct.
Representative Smith, there's no presumed prison time, right? Jail time can always be imposed as a condition of probation, and often is in sex offenses.
So Ms. Toombs, okay, prison meaning more than a year, generally speaking, jail meaning less than a year. So then on the column D, and on that line, I'm looking at two boxes of 36 and 48, no presumed prison time, were cases involving penetration. So the recommendation is we should not consider putting in prison someone who's engaged in penetration. Is that what I'm looking at?
Yeah, I see what you're looking at. I'm just holding here. You got to remember in looking at your crim sexes, crim sex 1 and crim sex 2, and they don't fall on the same severity levels now. Crim sex 1 is on 9 and 8, and crim sex 2 is on 8 and 7. It depends on the relationship between the offender. What we try to do is to mimic, and I'm looking for what was current law and increase the sentence.
Was that question asked and answered? Because I have an additional question. Two questions. We've heard on the previous recommendations, pages 11 through 19, the timing involved, recommendations, and so forth. The same holds true for the proposed sex offender grid.
It's my understanding, Chairman, yes.
I understand, though, the issue of timing of delivery of this report has been called into question. The report was due by January 1st, and I think there is an issue of it having been delivered January 3rd of this year?
That is correct, Representative, and I take full responsibility. I believe it was...
Not asking for anything in that nature. I'm just trying to understand maybe what your position... Maybe you can advise me now. I think my thought would be, perhaps, that if this was not timely delivered, being delivered on the 3rd, then the legislature is not required to act on this during this session, and then, therefore, these recommendations do not, by law, become in effect in August. Would you agree with that statement or not?
Chairman Smith, that is one way to summarize it. That it would be was a reasonable attempt made to deliver it in a timely manner. I mean, there's two different ways to look at it.
Some of us remember a veto on a bill some years ago. That was a very good one. Well, you know, I kind of like our legislature, even though we don't agree on everything, I kind of like it acting and not have to wait 6 or 8 months to find out if some judge thinks otherwise. So, but it would appear to me that this was not timely delivered. It would also appear to me that if we have disagreement with some of these proposals, we don't have to do anything and nothing will take effect. I think that's a way to look at it. I'm through pontificating on the issue of timeliness. We should probably proceed with the balance of your presentation, see if we can conclude in about the next 5 minutes. I'm sorry, Representative Nelson, you had a question.
Let's move on.
Very good. Let's go forward, Ms. Toombs, please.
In addition to the modifications proposed and the sentencing offense grid, the separate one, we also recommend that the legislature consider creating an off-grid sex offense category in which there would be the worst of the worst. The terminology was heard consistently throughout last session, and it seems to be a struggle trying to define who is the worst of the worst. For that offense category, we thought an indeterminate sentence would be appropriate. We thought someone who had 3 or more prior sex conduct would be automatically placed in an indeterminate off-grid sentence. First-degree crim sex offenses involving penetration with 3 or more of the enhancing factors which we presented, which are torture of the victim, great bodily harm, mutilation, kidnapping, so forth. If you had a prior sex offense, you would only have to have 2 of these. If you were a first-time sex offender who created an atrocious sex crime, you could get an indeterminate life sentence right off the bat. So it's not predicated only on prior sex convictions. It's also predicated on the nature of the offense. Again, trying to really capture that worst of the worst offender who would be on a first-time criminal sex be eligible for an indeterminate life sentence. And by stating 3 or more, we thought we had done that.
Excuse me. Yes, Representative...
Could I just get a quick look at that other one? Can you go in reverse? One more. 3 or more is what I'm talking about. Okay, thanks.
That's a very just ordinary, I don't know. No aggravating factors. There's nothing in any of these proposals that would take away from the ability of the court to still do aggravated departures. So even though we've enhanced these sentences and so forth, there's nothing here that prevents the court from putting an aggravated departure on or doing a consecutive sentencing. And consecutive sentencing occur a lot with sex offenses because one of the prior criteria for consecutive sentencing is a prior person crime and so forth like that. So what we're giving is more ammunition, longer sentences, and the ability to continue doing what we're doing now for those cases. Looking at the sentences, we looked at sentences, the current presumptive, if we were sentencing them today, the current actual, what the courts are actually giving these people, which is, you know, again, taking into effect the large number of departures, and then the proposed sentence under the new proposal. And you can see with, and we've split this out by prior and no prior, because we thought that's important, because the prior offenses are sentenced significantly longer than the non-priors. You can see that for level 9, which is our most serious offense, is usually involving penetration, the sentence goes up considerably. But even, I guess maybe what I want you to notice is, even when, no, the presumptive sentence is one thing, what they're actually getting now is considerably higher than the presumptive. What we have to take into consideration is that we keep enhancing laws and lengthening sentences before we have the opportunity for the prior enhancement to actually take effect. Because if you're giving somebody 10 years and you increase it to 20 years, we don't even begin to see that impact until year 11. So if you increase the sentence back in 1991 or 2000, and then you increase it again in 2004, you haven't seen any impact of that increased sentence that you did in 2000. So it may make us feel better by doing that, but we're not really seeing the impact of sentencing policy that's already been enacted because of the length of time. And that's just something to consider because, you know, we're just keeping, we seem to be on this thing, but we never really give it a chance to see whether it made a difference or not. There's a prison vet impact with this, just like with every bill. And before you guys asked us to do it, we did it ourselves. And you can see that we will need additional, and again, this is a determinant sentencing, so we were easily able to identify people who would be eligible for this. About 580 beds over the 20-year period would be required, and 196 offenders currently going to prison receive longer prison sentences. We tried to, and again, indeterminate sentencing is very, very difficult to estimate bed impact because you have no idea of knowing, other than the minimum sentence, how long they're going to serve. But we looked at people who would who got aggravated departures, considerably long aggravated departures last year, and tried to put that into place, and we say that we'll probably need another 492 beds for that group. And so the impact is around 1,072 beds for this proposal that we have before you. Assuming, again, that no one gets paroled because past practices. And those are the information I'll give out to answer any questions.
I don't see any questions. Thank you for coming. You do a really good report and presentation to our committee, so I want to thank you for that. As always, I enjoy it. I asked a pointed question on the late delivery issue. Frankly, I think, don't know, but I think that we may be receiving proposed legislation from the administration, so I don't know that we should rest on the late delivery. I think we should resolve that, see what the governor has or what we choose to come up with as a committee, and then if we do that, to include the language in our omnibus judiciary bill at the end. That'd be my thought. Any additional thoughts? We need to revert back to the minutes, which we did not take up earlier. Representative Cornish moves approval of the minutes from the February 8, 2005 meeting. Any discussion on that? If not, those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. The motion prevails. The minutes are adopted. If there's nothing further, this meeting is adjourned.